Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the pieces of this war that is least attended to, I would argue, and certainly least understood by most of us, is the backdrop to it, the national context of deterring adversaries the old-fashioned way. We're preoccupied, many of us at least, with the day-to-day, the threats of elsewhere. But all of it ultimately comes under the umbrella of something that our guest for this very special one-hour-long edition of Secure Freedom Radio has devoted his life to thinking about, to understanding at the highest levels of the United States government, and now as a professor at the Graduate Department of Defense and Strategic Studies of Missouri State University. He's also the president and co-founder of the National Institute for Public Policy and one of truly the go-to men in America on nuclear deterrence. He is Dr. Keith Payne. Always welcome here, especially at the start of a new year. Keith Payne, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
I'd like to guess start with the sort of overview of the kind of international environment in which we find ourselves at the moment from the perspective of nuclear deterrence. Maybe we could start with Russia, our longtime superpower rival. How would you characterize today, Keith, what the Russians are doing with respect to their nuclear forces? And do you consider it to be a growing threat to this country?
That's a great question, and let me put a little bit of a backdrop to it so that the answer, you know, hopefully has a little more meaning than it otherwise might. When the Soviet Union fell and the Cold War was over, we had a good bit of euphoria in the belief that, and essentially, we would have a new world order that would be based on, you know, amity and benign relations and resolving conflicts without force. You'll recall that there was a lot of very happy talk about the future with the end of the Cold War. And then with the rise of terrorism, we focused a good bit and appropriately enough on the threat from Al-Qaeda and terrorist organizations. But what happened as a result of both the hopeful vision of the future with the fall of the Soviet Union and the rise of the terrorist threat is that we essentially took our eyes off of the notion that state-to-state threats were front and foremost a problem. Because the Soviet Union was no more, we were hopeful to be friends with China and so on. So that was, in a sense, kind of the afterglow of the end of the Cold War. Now, the reason I mention that is because where we are now is very different from what most folks expected out of what came to be called the post-Cold War world. Right, the post-Cold War world was supposed to be characterized by peaceful conflict resolution. We would have, if not an alliance with Russia, we would at least be on a friendly basis with Russia, and the world's problems would be solved relatively peacefully compared to what had preceded. Well, where we are now I call the post-Cold War world, because that post-Cold War New World Order that folks hoped for has not come to pass. And the most obvious part of that not coming to pass is where Russia now appears to be heading with regard to both its foreign policy goals and its nuclear modernization programs. And just to put it in a nutshell, what we see of Russia's foreign policy goals is characterized by serious designs to expand Russian influence. There's a great deal of talk about essentially restoring the old Soviet Union, not necessarily as a state, but as Russia's dominant sphere of influence, probably incorporating parts of it into Russia, and we've seen that already now with Crimea and parts of Georgia, and I'm sure Russia has designs on parts of eastern Ukraine. In other words, in a sense, what we see is this aggressive design that is clearly guiding Russian foreign policy that 10 years ago, really, the general notion was, that's impossible. That'll never happen again. There won't be any more changing of territorial boundaries by force in Europe. That's old world. And what we know now is it's very much new world. And so Russia is pursuing really a multiple-pronged approach. One, they have those as foreign policy goals, that is, expansion, retaking some areas, incorporating them into the Russian Federation directly in some ways. But at the nuclear level, I can tell you that the Russian nuclear modernization program is comparable, I would say, to the highest level of activity that the Soviet Union pursued during the Cold War. That's where we are in terms of the current threat environment. And now I'm just talking about Russia. We could talk about China, too.
Well, I want to talk about China in a moment, Keith, but just staying with Russia for a second. And again, our guest is Dr. Keith Payne, the president and co-founder of the National Institute for Public Policy, a longtime senior member of the Defense Department and participant in a number of important congressional commissions, including that on the strategic posture of the United States. And Keith, just staying with Russia, as I say, for a moment, what you've described as a level of activity in terms of modernizing its strategic forces arsenal, and I guess this would apply to its tactical nuclear weapons as well, at the levels of the highest activity of the Cold War is simply astounding, I think. Most Americans would find that unbelievable. Is it the case that literally every leg of their strategic triad is being modernized, and how would you characterize the quality, as best we can judge it, of the platforms and the weapons that are now being put into place by Vladimir Putin's regime?
Right. If you look at the Russian triad, and the triad is ICBMs or land-based missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and heavy bombers, that's the canonical triad. You see that the Russians have modernization programs going on in every leg of the triad. New ICBMs, new submarines for the submarine-launched ballistic missile force, and this is all based on the open Russian press, so I'm not talking out of school here. And if you look at the open Russian press, it may be that they have two heavy bombers on the boards for development. And it's not clear to me. They seem to be suggesting that they have two new strategic bombers. We know there's at least one, but the way they talk, there may be two.
And to the extent that they have been making this kind of investment in these expensive weapon systems, and I want to come back to how expensive they are in a moment with you, and we talk about our own. Keith, is there a similar kind of innovation and investment being made in the weapons the Russians are deploying on these platforms as well? In other words, are they modernizing the nuclear arms that go on these weapon systems as well as the delivery systems?
Yes, according again to the Russian press, it's not just that they have new systems in development and production. The modernization of the systems they also talk about. Let me just give you one example. There's a missile called the YARS, or the RS-24, and they're already talking about, in the open press, the YARS-M, and that means YARS modified. And in the open press, they say this could have more warheads on it than the YARS, could be more accurate warheads, and may even be maneuvering warheads. That's the kind of innovations that their open press talks about with regard to their new systems.
And I guess the key point here, as we'll come to in a moment, is the contrast between this level of activity, this commitment of resources, this perception of the abiding value of these deterrent capabilities, or for that matter, nuclear warfighting capabilities, with the counterpart program of the United States, which is to say, not very damn much. And when we come back, Keith, I want to add further texture to that by asking you to round out a little further the sort of threat environment in which we are allowing what I believe is the hollowing out of our nuclear deterrent. by talking a bit about the investment that the Chinese are making at the same time all of this is going on in Russia. We'll be covering that subject and much more with Dr. Keith Payne, one of the country's preeminent authorities on nuclear forces and deterrence in practice as well as in theory, now with the National Institute for Public Policy and our guest for this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting with Dr. Keith Payne, the founder, co-founder, and president of the National Institute for Public Policy, an extraordinarily important institution in Washington, D.C., specializing particularly in maintaining the corporate memory on matters involving nuclear deterrence, most especially. He is also a profoundly influential figure in academia as the head of the Graduate Department of Defense and Strategic Studies of Missouri State University, an organization established by the late and extraordinarily lamented William Van Cleve. Keith Payne, again, thank you for this time. You had one further thought you wanted to leave us with on Russia, and then we'll turn to China very quickly.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Frank. You asked about the comparison between Russian activity and U.S. activity, and that can be captured really easily. The Russian Federation officials identify their nuclear modernization program as their highest defense priority, and they've said this for years now. And in fact, even most recently, they said whatever the level of value that oil goes to, however their budget is affected, their nuclear modernization programs remain the highest priority. On the U.S. side, we have a standing policy that the United States will develop and deploy no new nuclear capabilities.
Yeah. Worse, as we'll talk about in a moment, we have a policy out of the Obama administration that says it is our purpose to rid the world of all of these weapons, and it certainly seems as though he has in mind starting with ours. And Keith, I guess just a word on whether this level of investment, this commitment, this priority being assigned to these systems by Vladimir Putin applies as well to the so-called tactical nuclear weapons, sort of theater shorter range systems as well?
Right, and this is a huge controversy because what we know now is that the Russian Federation is violating the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which is one of the so-called keystones of arms control agreements for nuclear weapons. And folks, a number of us have suspected that Russia was violating that treaty for years because it was talked about in the open press in ways that indicated violation.
And yet the Russians were conducting this, and the United States government was going to great lengths to conceal it. Our guest is Keith Payne. He is the president and co-founder of the National Institute for Public Policy. He served as a deputy assistant secretary of defense with responsibility, among other things, for nuclear forces and arms control policy in the George W. Bush administration. His most recent book, I believe, is The Great American Gamble, Deterrence Policy and Theory from the Cold War to the 21st Century. And Keith, just finish that thought on Russian tactical nuclear forces and their violation of the INF Treaty.
Right. As I said, a number of us had thought from Russian press that it had been that the Russians were in violation. The Obama administration last year came out and said explicitly, yes, the Russians are in violation of the treaty. Of course, the Russians have denied that. But the point is, those violations appear to be a reflection of Russian interest in continuing modernization of its shorter-range so-called tactical nuclear weapons. And perhaps to put a cap on this discussion, Foreign Minister Lavrov said, just a few weeks ago, that it wasn't excluded that Russia had the prerogative of putting its tactical nuclear weapons in Crimea, which Russia just essentially took from Ukraine and has absorbed, and now they're saying they can have the prerogative of putting nuclear weapons there if they choose to. That gives you an idea of the Russian view of both nuclear weapons and how they view Central Europe.
They see them as usable weapons, in short, something that, as I recall, the Soviets did in the past as well. And again, most Americans find unimaginable, I think. And it's made worse, Dr. Payne, as you know, by the fact that the Russians actually periodically threaten the use of nuclear weapons against our friends and allies, and even on occasion, I think, against us. Is that right?
Well, that periodically has gained momentum over the last handful of years, as we've seen Russian nuclear threats to our European allies and not too implicit Russian nuclear threats to the United States. As a matter of fact, when some of the densest fighting was going on in Ukraine, the Russians had a very large nuclear exercise at the same time that the fighting was going on in Ukraine last year. Again, this gives you an idea of the level of both explicit and implicit nuclear threats that the Russian Federation has been engaging in more and more over the last handful of years.
And am I right that frequently, if not with great regularity, Putin presides over these or participates in these exercises himself?
Yeah, in the Russian open press and open television, we see Putin engaging personally in these exercises.
Yeah. When we think about the President of the United States whispering into Vladimir Putin's number two, Dmitry Medvedev, before the last election, that he'd have more flexibility in dealing with the Russians, it's almost unimaginable that you could have an even more dramatic difference between the attitude and posture and policy predilections, if I could call them that, of the Russians and the United States. But to add further texture to this, let's turn to China, shall we? Keith Payne, again, from the National Institute for Public Policy. We're dealing with open source material, not the classified, but there's a lot of information in the open source literature about, among other things, something that strikes me as so indicative of this attachment on the part of the Chinese to their nuclear strike capabilities, and that is something called the Great Underground Wall of China. Talk a little bit about that and what it says just about the forces that might be concealed there.
Right. Well, we know from, again, open publications and Chinese discussions in Chinese press that China has what's called the Great Underground Wall. It's miles and miles and miles of underground tunnels.
By some estimates, 3,000 miles, to be precise. Unbelievable.
We get various estimates. Some estimates are higher than that. It's breathtaking what the Chinese have decided to do in terms of these underground tunnels, their length and breadth and so on. And so then the open question is, essentially, what are they putting in those tunnels? I mean, they're not doing it to hide cabbage, right? They obviously have important military functions going on in those tunnels, and so the question is, what percentage of that or what proportion of those functions that the military functions going on underground are nuclear? And you know why this matters is because we would like to have as much transparency, as much insight into Chinese nuclear capabilities as possible, for obvious reasons.
Not least of which is to be sure that we're capable of deterring any threat from that quarter.
Exactly right. So if knowing what's going on is important, and it really is for precisely the reasons you mentioned, having the great underground wall of tunnels and miles of tunnels and possibly a good bit of nuclear activity going on in those tunnels, is very troubling.
It is indeed. And so is the burrowing into a mountain down off the coast of China for a very hardened submarine facility and the investment in aircraft for nuclear delivery, as well as a whole array of land and sea-based missiles. Give us again, if you would, Keith, kind of a 30,000-foot level of what kinds of offensive capabilities the Chinese now have in terms of both the numbers of warheads, if you'd care to hazard a guess, and this capacity to really quite credibly rain down immense death and destruction in this country.
Right. Let me not provide a number on the Chinese nuclear weapons, because the calculations of that vary so greatly that I don't want to claim one as more right than another.
Hold the thought, Keith. We're going to have to pause for just a second. I'm afraid I don't want to miss a word of this. This is really critically important, what the Chinese are up to and where they're going to go from here, especially if they are able to conceal from us their capabilities as well as their intentions. Dr. Keith Payne is our guest for this hour of a very special conversation about nuclear deterrence and whether we're doing what we need to maintain it in this country, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 5 years ago, Representative Joe Wilson challenged falsehoods President Obama was spewing before a joint session of Congress by shouting, "You lie." That didn't happen in the House chamber during last night's State of the Union address, but presidential mendacity was much in evidence. Notably, Mr. Obama claimed that, quote, "we've halted the progress of Iran's nuclear program and reduced its stockpile of nuclear material," unquote. In fact, under the deal he is negotiating, the mullahs are continuing to enrich uranium, continuing to build the infrastructure to produce more of it, and continuing to develop reactors and centrifuges that will be used to amass a substantial and threatening nuclear arsenal. And that's just the parts of Iran's nuclear weapons program we know about. Its unacknowledged covert activities make the president's lie even more outlandish and dangerous. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Our guest is Dr. Keith Payne, by my money, one of the preeminent authorities, certainly of his generation, on matters involving nuclear forces, arms control, deterrence. He's a practitioner as well as one of the most accomplished theoreticians in this very exotic bit of tradecraft in the national security arena. He has written extensively on these matters, notably, but not exclusively, in book-length form. His book in 2008, Deterrence, Policy, and Theory from the Cold War to the 21st Century, is really required reading in the field. He is the president and co-founder of the National Institute for Public Policy. And Keith, you were describing a bit of what the Chinese are doing, and I could not draw you out on how large a force they may actually have. You're right, it is a matter of considerable controversy. But talk about the kinds of capabilities that we are seeing being brought to bear.
Well, and in terms of the estimates of the numbers, I mean, one of the reasons why it's important to talk about the estimates of the numbers is because there's so much difference in these estimates. It gives you an idea of the lack of transparency we have in the Chinese nuclear capabilities. So, for example, the open U.S. estimate, the public U.S. estimate, focuses on a couple hundred Chinese nuclear weapons. The Republic of China, that's estimate in the most recent public white paper that came out of the Republic of China, puts it at 400 to 500. Russian estimates, according to Russian experts who have focused on China in the past, are that China could have up to 1,500 nuclear weapons. So you look at several hundred to up to 1,500 nuclear weapons from these various estimates, and you realize how difficult it is to try and come up with a serious, credible answer to the question.
But again, just to tie in what we talked about a moment ago, because I think it's so illuminating, if I can use that expression, in a non-transparent environment, Keith, is Phil Carber, one of our friends and colleagues at Georgetown University, as you know, has done a lot of very creative work with undergraduate and graduate students of his there to try to, well, draw conclusions from the level of investment being made in that underground Great Wall and what they're likely to be able to field as a result. Do you have any thoughts on what he's concluded, which as I understand it is that it's at least 1,500 and could be considerably more nuclear weapons that are being squirreled away in that regard?
I have a lot of respect for Dr. Carver and the work he's done on that. The numbers that I tend to talk about openly, because the Russians talk about them openly, really sort of follow the same methodology, and that is, you know, how much fission material do they have? How much could they produce given the amount of fission material they have? And as I said, the Russian estimate goes from 1,500 to somewhat higher. And I think that fits in with what Dr. Carver has talked about as well.
When you look at the rest of the world, the Chinese, like the Russians, periodically making threats against this country. I think it was about 6 months or so ago the Chinese actually had a kind of press extravaganza about submarine-launched ballistic missiles being able to strike and kill millions of Americans. What do you make of what these guys are conveying to us as they build this kind of capacity to attack the United States and feel sufficiently brazen about, you know, brandishing the threat? Is this something that ought to really command our attention in terms of our thinking of the adequacy of our deterrent posture?
Right. And the Chinese periodical that you mentioned actually had on a page a map of the United States showing where the nuclear detonations could take place and how many millions of Americans could be killed based on that attack. And to think that that's not sending us a message would be wholly naive. Where does that come from? I mean, is your basic question, what are they trying to do with that? I can tell you what my studies have suggested with regard to why are the Chinese both modernizing their nuclear forces and engaging in that kind of strong-arm threat activity. It's because they want to essentially let the United States know that the Asian area, particularly the South and East China Seas, are theirs, and that we better think twice about interfering as they pursue what I think everybody would recognize as a very aggressive expansionist foreign policy in the East and South China Seas. Let me give you an example. So Japanese Prime Minister Abe has said that the situation that Japan and China are in right now is very similar to the situation that Europe was in immediately prior to World War I, clearly drawing the analogy between China and Imperial Germany. And both China and Japan have said they wouldn't be surprised if a war broke out. Now, what that tells you is that the Chinese are pressing the Japanese and others, other than their neighbors, some of our allies and best allies and friends, you know, very hard in terms of Chinese claims in the area. And I think that the nuclear threats and the nuclear capabilities from China are to let the United States know it wants to do what it plans on doing, and the United States had better think twice and three times really hard before the United States might consider intervening to prevent China from carrying out its foreign policy goals.
I think that's the only reasonable conclusion to draw, and whether it's worse than that, that they actually mean what they're saying in terms of these threats to attack and devastate millions of Americans just makes it that much more urgent that we be taking seriously these challenges. And let me now come again. We could talk at length and for days, really, with you, Keith Payne, about the other threats that are emerging, the North Korean capabilities, the Iranian capabilities, Pakistan's growing arsenal, perhaps a Saudi nuclear force in response to an Iranian one, and beyond. People who are now getting their hands on the most dangerous weapons ever invented, and to varying degrees brandishing them, is again the backdrop for the conversation that I've really wanted to come to now, and that is, what are we doing to maintain a corresponding deterrent capability? You talked a bit about the president's policy views, but how is that translating into the actual condition of our arsenal and its future sustainability, in your professional judgment, Dr. Keith Payne?
Well, the administration has made commitments to modernizing the U.S. nuclear triad, and that is moving towards a new ICBM, a new bomber, and a follow-on to our existing submarine launch capabilities. My concern is that that those commitments may be delayed considerably, they may be reduced considerably, and I don't think anybody who's involved in this business feels anything other than concerned, for those of us who care about this, other than concerned that those modernization programs that the administration has made the commitment to will actually be carried out in a timely way. Because what you have juxtaposed to those commitments made to modernize the triad, as Frank, you know, are the profound commitments that the administration has made to moving to nuclear zero, to reducing U.S. nuclear forces further. In fact, the most recent approach by the Obama administration was that the United States could go down by another third, even from those levels that we went down to or going down to under the New START treaty, so a third below. So I think the language is that we will not do this unilaterally, but the question is, well, does that mean it would be done by a treaty or an executive agreement? The idea of a treaty with Russia now, I think, is a bit far-fetched. So the question is, you know, is the administration so dedicated to moving down to a third lower from the ceilings of New START that it might do it as an executive agreement with reciprocity with Russia? But what we know is, when agreements are based on reciprocity with Russia, Russia violates them. I mean, that's the history.
Yeah, even when it's not reciprocity, when it's one that they're parties to, they seem to violate it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that phenomenon and its implications with Keith Payne in our final installment of this very special program on nuclear deterrence and security in a dynamic environment where enemies of this country, I think, clearly are now on the march and taking our measure as inadequate to deter them. We'll explore that proposition further with Dr. Keith Payne of the National Institute for Public Policy right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today,
all right, let's go,
or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Dr. Keith Payne is our guest. He is, I think, truly a standout in terms of the practitioners of national security policy for his acumen and experience in the business of nuclear deterrence. And Keith, just finish that thought on how the policy of the Obama administration has really signaled to adversaries as well as friends that we're sort of bent on going out of this business, it seems to me. Delays of the modernization program, cuts, perhaps unilateral or certainly unreciprocated if it's done in a treaty context, given the Russians' predilections. But are we, in fact, even
doing what we need to do, in your judgment, to maintain the forces that we have? I kind of find that most Americans, if they think about these things at all, assume that we're, you know, making a very determined effort to ensure that these weapon systems are up to snuff, and that the industrial base to support them is robust, and that the expertise of the personnel couldn't be improved and all that. Is that so, in your judgment?
Well, there have been a number of recent reports that have come out, actually official reports, unclassified reports, that have indicated that the morale of our forces in this area is very low, and that the type of perfectionism that was required in the past is difficult to attain if morale is very low. And then the question is, well, why is morale low? And at least one of the answers that has come out from these reports, open reports, is that morale tends to be low because the enterprise that they're involved in, that is nuclear deterrence and nuclear forces, is not essentially identified as the priority goal of the military, and that is to protect the United States and allies from nuclear attack. In other words, the constant discussion of nuclear weapons as something that we should be moving away from, getting to zero, that we shouldn't be relying on nuclear weapons and on nuclear deterrence, despite whatever good intentions might be behind those type of constant admonitions, what it tells the folks who are involved in trying to maintain the U.S. deterrent is what they're doing is perhaps less important than many other things. And so this type of concern on part of the folks who are involved that what they're doing is less important in the view of the leadership, that there may not be a very good career path to be in, given that view, you know, it has clearly a negative impact on the morale of the folks involved. And as you know, Frank, you know, in this business, people tend to be everything. We require a high level of professionalism from the people involved. And if that starts to wane, then it opens up the potential for all kinds of other troubles. Let me add, I should right away, that I know many people who are involved in maintaining the U.S. nuclear deterrent, both on the civilian side and the military side. And what you find is a very, very professional, high-quality group of people. So I don't want to be misunderstood and think, in my saying that, you know, these aren't other than very, very fine servants of the United States. But clearly the morale problem is one that's been pointed to by these official reports, and it's something that's a real concern.
But let me ask you about one other piece of this, Keith, because I think you're absolutely right. We've been blessed over the years, even today, I gather, by exceptionally dedicated individuals in uniform and out trying to make this work. But they are being denied the tool that arguably has most reliably over the decades we've had nuclear forces been used to assure the performance and the safety and the reliability of our deterrent forces, namely nuclear testing. And as you know from your time in the George W. Bush administration, that was not something that was resumed. There's no evidence that this administration or, frankly, perhaps any of either party might do it. How is it that we find the Russians modernizing their nuclear forces, the Chinese modernizing their nuclear forces, maintaining presumably a high level of confidence in them, and yet we're unable, as a practical matter, to bring to bear this kind of reliability tool, is I guess the way I think of it, even to maintain the stuff that we've got? Is that a serious problem?
You know, and that's the great question. Does the United States need to go back to nuclear testing to maintain an arsenal that's reliable and so on? You know, the answer that the folks at the lab say is we don't necessarily need to do that, at least not right now, because the various computational capabilities allow us to carry on reliably and credibly without going back to nuclear testing. You know, I think in a sense that the answer is not yet in on exactly how that's going to go. I mean, the basic tenets of science are that you put forth hypotheses and then you go test it in the real world. And so the question of whether you can move away from that foundational part of science and maintain an arsenal that you consider reliable and accurate and so on and so forth, I think is an open question. You know, what I can say is that, at least according to open Russian reports, and here again I'm just commenting on open Russian reports, is that the Russians may not be following this no test approach as explicitly and as accurately as we are.
Well, they actually insisted on a different definition, as I recall, in the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was not followed by us and gave them greater latitude. Is that right?
Well, I should point to the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission report of 2009, and the language in there says that apparently the Russians are engaging in what amounts to very, very low yield testing. I'll not comment any further, but to point to the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission report that uses the word apparently when referring to that.
Yeah. Well, it certainly does raise the hoary question that we are unilaterally restricting ourselves in a capability that has proven in the past, again, to be necessary. My guess is it will continue to be in the future. I only pray we'll be able to exploit it once again. Keith, we're almost at the end of our time together, and I wanted to leave you with one, or draw you out, I guess, on one question that came up in a recent interview that I did about the Cuban role, perhaps, in all of this. One thing that is afoot, as you know, as a result of the normalization of relations with Cuba, is some talk about the president deciding to give back to the Cubans Guantanamo Bay. And one of the things that Jaime suggested is that a result of that could be that that deep water port at the end of the Cuban island could become a base for attack submarines of Russia, China, perhaps Iran. What might that mean? And again, the dynamic of deterrence, if not too far from Kings Bay, Georgia, or one of our major submarine ballistic missile submarine bases, you had that kind of threatening capability. Is that a problem?
Well, during the Cold War, we know that the Soviets had Russian subs. Again, this is fully open information. The Soviets had Russian subs, off our shores on occasion. In fact, according to the Open Press, the Russians are again putting subs, off our shores. You can only imagine that problem could get much more serious if what you describe, Frank, actually takes place.
Yeah. Well, and to the extent that this is really at the core of a secure deterrent, we need to be thinking about these sorts of dynamics as well as the larger problem of maintaining an effective, safe, and reliable deterrent. And no one has been thinking more seriously about that for longer, at the moment at least, than you, Keith Payne. We are so grateful to you, both for the work you do at the National Institute for Public Policy and the Graduate Department of Defense and Strategic Studies at Missouri State University, and especially for your periodic visits with us. I hope you'll come back often in 2015. There's much more to talk about. But thank you for taking this hour with us, and keep up the great work. We hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.